Como seu trabalho era importante para a França?
Todas as informações são importantes. Mas era sobretudo para mostrar que a França era um país amigo. Os brasileiros tinham mais necessidade de tal material. Estávamos dispostos a vender, tínhamos necessidade de fabricar.
De quais materiais?
Materiais de aviação. Tínhamos conhecimentos técnicos, mas o que era importante é que podíamos ir aos nossos superiores pedir informação para os brasileiros.
No livro, o senhor narra um episódio de tortura de uma mulher que veio ao Brasil para, segundo o general Figueiredo, espionar o senhor. Figueiredo fez vir de Manaus às pressas para mostrar a moça, já irreconhecível depois das sessões de tortura. Ele depois informou que ela morrerá no hospital. Nunca se questionou sobre o método bárbaro usado para obter informações daquela mulher?
Não é de jeito nenhum. A morte dessa mulher era um ato de defesa.
Qual é a sua impressão sobre os presidentes militares, como Ernesto Geisel, João Figueiredo e Garrastazu Médici?
Ernesto Geisel era um homem racional, de uma profunda moralidade. Era um homem que tinha uma fé religiosa, respeitava as regras da moral cristã e considera que os homens merecem viver numa atmosfera de ordem que lhes permite trabalhar, cuidar da família. De Emílio Garrastazu Médici, tenho boas lembranças. Conheci-o na Embaixada da França. Conversamos um pouco. João Figueiredo era adorado, sedutor. Era o chefe do SNI quando eu cheguei como adido. O representante francês dos serviços especiais no Brasil me disse: todo mundo sabe que você faz parte do serviço de inteligência francês. Principalmente do Action. Logo, não deve esconder. Você vem contra Figueiredo, chefe do SNI, ou esconda que você pertenceu aos serviços equivalentes na França.
Vocês ficam amigos?
Muito amigos. Acho que Figueiredo apreciou minha conduta em relação ao brasileiro. Minha contribuição foi apreciada. Minha colaboração foi frutuosa para ele e para nós.
Ele queria substituir Figueiredo.
So my concept of perception attack is meant to approach the question of preemptive war from a certain angle. The concept of preemption realigns the theory and practice of war on time, and it does it in a way that reproblematizes perception and, obviously, because it has to do with time, memory. So what I'd like to do is just create a little bit of a context for thinking through of how that might play out. We remember what we do not see. This is how Governor George Pataki of New York, pious before unseen towers, inaugurated the 2004 Republican Party convention that was to carry George W. Bush to a second term in office, riding the surf of 9/11 and the war on terror one last time before the swell subsided. Standing in the ebb, far from ground zero, 2.5 years later, a reminder may be in order that the swell at the time, was more like a tidal wave. It burst levees, eroded embankments, and laid down sediment, leaving the political landforms over which it swept reshaped. The governor's dictum might capture something more of the altered landscape than it might first appear from its offering as a rhetorical flourish. It locates the flourishing of the political between memory and perception. This would be familiar ground where the relation between the two is presented, were the relation between the two presented as one of continuity. Pataki, however, syncopates them. They both still occur, but not on beat. Perception and memory fall out of step. What we're aware of in the present falls out of step with what is retained from the past as still having the power to affect. This disallows an ordered correlation or step-by-step progression between memory and perception. This, in turn, takes the ground out from under the notion of representation as applied to politics. It also makes a directly political issue of time by reopening the question of how the present's relation to the past, or for that matter, the present's relation to itself, is politically operationalized. Soren Kierkegaard distinguished two regimes of memory. What is recollected, has been, he said, is repeated backward, whereas repetition is recollected forward. Whereas memory, as normally understood, is a recollection of what has been, repetition is a recollection of what has not yet come, a memory of the future. This is not so hard to grasp if we think of repetition as self-contracting on the model of habit. We say we have a habit, but we all know that it's really the habit that has gotten hold of us. It is an automatism that inhabits us. It is of its nature as an automatism to pass under the radar of awareness. We are only ever aware of an habitual action having occurred. What we consciously perceive are its next effects. Otherwise, we would catch it in the act and decide to execute the action or not, in which case it will not have acted as a habit. A habit is self-deciding. It is a self-effecting force from the past that acts in a present which appears only in a next effect. The present of this force's actual operation is elided. This is a kind of syncopation of time itself, where the skipped beat is the operative present, the present of the operation. This active present is expressed only in the nextness which comes of it. It actively disappears into its forward expression. We normally think of habit as bare repetition and of repetition as barren by nature. But for Kierkegaard, as for Nietzsche and Deleuze, repetition is a positive force, carrying the past forward into a next expression. It is a positively organizing, even creative force of time. This implies that it may be captured and put to use. The elision of the operative moment may be operationalized. The United States Defense Advanced Research Agency, or DARPA, knows this. It is an off step or two ahead of Governor Pataki. Like him, it knows that we habitually remember what we do not see. It also knows, like him, that this is a political time issue critical to the so-called war on terror. But it goes further to the philosophical realization that there is a positive power to repetition, which means that it is not barren and even so humdrums a species of it as habit partakes of the creative force of time. We need only think of attention. Thank you. as habit, partakes of the creative force of time. We need only think of attention. Attention is the base state habit of perception. Every awareness begins in a shift. We think of ourselves as directing the shifts in our attention, but if you pay attention to paying attention, you quickly sense that rather than you directing your attention, your attention is directing you. It pulls you into your coming perception, which dawns on you as attention's next effect. Attention is a perceptual automatism that consists in tagging a change in the perceptual field as new and potentially important and building awareness on that change for the very good reason that it may signal a necessity of a response or an opportunity for action. The next perception into which you are pulled is already a convocation to action and reaction. According to contemporary perception studies, this happens in the elided present of a repetition, in a confirmation of attention's habitual nature. DARPA is preoccupied with the possibility of operationalizing the elided present of attention. Their interest is to be seen against the backdrop of the realignment of military doctrine over the last 15 years on what is called full spectrum force. This is the extension of military affairs to, quote, gray areas involving non-traditional operations other than war, OOTW, in the words of Ullman and Wade, the authors of the famous book Shock and Awe, one of the classic statements of the doctrine of full spectrum force. This expansion in the purview of military operation is a response to the blurring of boundaries characterizing contemporary war, in which the archetype of the enemy is no longer the uniformed soldier, but the terrorist, the assumed organization of the adversary, as another contemporary classic of war theory drives home, Arkila and Ronfeld's Networks and Net Wars, is then no longer the identifiable regular army in its centralized state scaffolding, but the diffuseness of the network. The network is recessive. It melts into the population. Arkila and Ronfeld call it unbounded and expanding. It is pervasive. It insinuates itself across the technological and communicational nerve paths of society. The attacks it enables erupt without warning. They rise up from within an unbounded field rather than striking out in a determinable direction from a locatable base. NetWar's infiltrating reach is potentially coextensive with social and cultural space. This irrevocably blurs the boundaries between the civil and military spheres. Other boundaries blur as a consequence, for example, between offense and defense. When the civil is no longer clearly demarcated from the military, nor offense from defense, it becomes impossible to say where the exercise of force begins and ends. Military affairs bleed across the spectrum. They span a continuum stretched between two poles or extremes. At one end lies the traditional application of force on force, again in Ullman and Wade's words. This is the pole of traditional engagement on the model of the battle, siege, or occupation. At the other pole lies what they call soft power. As a first approximation, soft power can be understood as the military use of information and disinformation and of psyops, or what used to be called psychological warfare. Arkila and Ronfelt characterize soft power as epistemological warfare because its business is what people know or think they know. Of course, epistemological warfare is nothing new, as the last presentation showed, but the paradigm has significantly shifted. Traditionally, what is now called soft power was a helper to hard power. It was secondary to force on force, whose effectiveness it was meant to boost. It was an additive, like leavening. Now, on the other hand, according to Arkila and Ronfelt, all conflict is by nature epistemological. Soft power, rather than an additive or booster, is a baseline state. This is a necessary consequence of the full spectrum situation. War is no longer punctual, like a battle. It is on low boil all the time. It is no longer localized, like an occupation. The heat is everywhere. The definition of action underpinning the force on force of hard power is fundamentally that of friction, matter on matter, metal on metal, projectile against shielding, metal in flesh, flesh splayed, splashed on hard surfaces, force of attack against opposing force of resistance. The overall aim of this force against force is attrition. It meets the enemy head on and wears down his capabilities across an extensive series of frictional engagements. Its aims and means are painfully tangible. In the current field of conflict, this kind of punctual engagement has lost its centrality. It has been replaced by waiting. Being in the thick of war has been watered down and drawn out into an endless waiting, both sides poised for action. The baseline state is now the always-on of low boil, poising for action. One is always in the thin of it. When a strike of force against force does come, it stands out against the background continuity of this thin condition, which Paul Virilio presciently called the non-battle, years before it became the obsessive concern of leaders, both military and civilian. When it comes, the eruption of action is an ebullition, a momentary boiling over in this low-intensity broth of the always-on conflict of the non-battle. Soft power is how you act militarily in waiting when you're not yet tangibly acting. It is a way of preventing the wait itself from being an attrition, or even a way of turning it to advantage. In the condition of non-battle, when you have nothing on which to act tangibly, there's still one thing you can do. Act on that very condition. Act to change the conditions in which you wait. After all, it is from these same conditions that any action to come will have emerged. By acting on the wait time conditions in the intervals between boilings over, you may well be able to reduce the potential of an eventual attack, moderate its powers of attrition if it comes, or even better, induce it to take tangible shape when and where you are ready for it. That way you have a chance of disabling it before it reaches its full magnitude, or even in the case where it bursts forth at full strength, you can be reasonably confident that you'll be able to respond to it with rapid and overwhelming force. Thus you take as your military field of operation the environmental conditions in which both combatants and the non-combatant population lives, what Ullman and Wade call the total situation. The only way to act on the total situation is to act on the conditions of emergence of the battle prior to its occurrence. These conditions concern threats which, in the parlance of the doctrine of preemption, are not yet fully formed. What is not yet fully formed is still in potential. It may already be on the horizon, brewing like a recipe for disaster, or ominously looming like an unclear, almost present threat. It carries an irreducible degree of indeterminacy. The measure of indeterminacy makes it as intangible as it is ominous. It's a tall order. You must act totally on the intangibles of the situation. The ultimate boundary blurred is that between the tangible and the intangible, the corporeal and the incorporeal, because to act on the former, you have to act on the latter. There are two ways to act totally and intangibly on a situation. The first is by transposing your action from the spatial axis of battle, siege, or occupation onto a time axis. You operate in and on the interval in which what is not yet fully formed is already imperceptibly brewing. You can act on that almost present in order to influence the active form of its next awaited emergence. Preemption is proaction, action on the conditions of action prior to its actually taking shape. The second way to act totally and intangibly on a situation is to act on perception. It is perception which prepares a body for action and reaction. By modulating perception, you can already modulate subsequent action, reaction. This, in fact, makes perception a kind of royal road to the almost present. The two ways of acting intangibly with a view to the total situation converge.
What you're doing with all that don't make no difference where you are. It seems unreal up here, stranded on a star. I see the earth spinning down below, and I've been wondering why it seems to go so slow. Up above me, the shining face, right beneath me, I see your face. It isn't the sun. I don't think it's the sky. I don't even know if it's someone's inner eye. It makes no difference and couldn't care less, but baby, please get me away from this mess. I don't know how to fly. From the eastern wind, the spaceship roars. Here comes up silent with a radiating door. Inside the spaceship, people looking out in it, wondering what it's all about. Will they ever get off? I wonder. I've been down here looking, but I can't seem to find the door. Up above me is shining down. The whirling face is spinning and it looks like a clown. Dancing through the sky on gilded wings comes an angel without a sin. It looks like me, but I couldn't be sure. Then all of a sudden it's just a door and I fall. Remains my dream. I'm spinning in a wheeling, but I can't scream. It seems like a joke.
Forgetting you and
never let each other alone. Find my shoe, it gave itself to you before your being. And his hair doesn't care which way it goes to flow. Then a mountain, it rams, it comes out the other side. Now you're falling through space, time and space. Everybody, 15, what doesn't know will grow you. I love you. So you think you're off the wheel, but how cosmic is the seed implanted in your soul? My eye stays open because my right think of you in time when you never saw the sky fell beneath his eyes. Thought it was yours, didn't fly, didn't fly. Baby, you tell me I believe. Seems like the best thing to do. It really didn't matter who we were through, cause life is a bird flying. The wind is a spirit singing. A butterfly bird is winging. Past your eye, you didn't know why it seems fine. The sun is your star, planets are spinning, your inner glass jar, holding a candle. God is inside.
That anthropology is not to occupy in the present century the same role of modern science and extended paradigm that physics played during the modern period. Anthropology would be thus in a position to furnish the new metaphysics of the Anthropocene, the epoch when humanity became a molecular multiplicity and a physically molar agent at the same time. And this is one of the reasons, I might say, that I have less misgivings than many of my colleagues about the appropriateness of this term, Anthropocene, to designate the new deep historical epoch we have entered. But I think maybe we have it that we are entering as a philosopher suggested an era in which anthropology will be playing a paradigmatic role, comparable to the role that physics played. In love with respect to Latour's ongoing project of writing an anthropology of the moderns, that's how I put it, and it's a recent book, actually, it's an inventory of the different modes of existence. Modes of existence recognized as through a glass darkly, though, but recognized anyway, that by the ontology of the moderns. That's how Manivier described this project of the anthropology of the moderns. I quote, "The difference between Latour and his predecessors, Manivier is taken here of classic metaphysicians, either early modern or late postmodern metaphysicians. The difference between Latour and his predecessors is not the content of his metaphysics, but in the very meaning of the exercise. But this meaning is diplomatic. The point is to negotiate the meeting and the confusion of ontologies. Metaphysics is therefore wholly anthropological. If you are willing to define anthropology as that kind of knowledge, savoir in French, that kind of knowledge that explores the difference between our more deeply ingrained evidences in order to produce not a knowledge of something, a savoir de quelque chose, savoir sur quelque chose, not a knowledge of something, but a redescription of ourselves in the light of alterity." End quote. Or, as in the famous Wagnerian one-liner, "Every understanding of another culture is an experiment but one's own." Or, as Manivier himself puts it in another occasion, more concisely, "Anthropology is the formal ontology of ourselves as variants." They should at least begin to calm all the qualms about the necessary presupposition of a meta-ontological level underlying the notion of ontological authority. Another part of the paper is called "One or Several Wolves." This is the title, as you know, of the second chapter of Adult Plateaus by Deleuze and Guattari. And you see that the motive or positiveness of this type of person. But my problem here now is the grammar of the concept of ontology, as we would say in the good old days of the linguistic term. What is the grammar of ontology? Well, Peter Skafish, our colleague, remarks on the, what he calls, incredulity and shock, end quote, with which many students and scholars have received the introduction of the term ontology in contemporary anthropological discourse, given its I quote, "metaphysical, essentialist, absolutist connotations," end quote. I believe he's citing Matt King here, which the sentiment is certainly widespread, this term ontology. Why would they bring such not the only philosophically charged word in the anthropology. Not to speak of the very name of the discipline, a compound of two metaphysical essentialist central concepts. Not to mention the very name of the discipline, we have been happily playing along with words like politics, or myth, or philosophical falsity. If ever there was one, it was invented by philosophers to describe what was not philosophy. So that's a purely philosophical concept. We have been playing along with this concept of politics or myth without much ado. When it comes to ontology, we come home. But what enough with ontology to enter the stage to having some metaphysics? The tacit, and I go to stage again, the tacit metaphysics of anthropology, that poorly mixed, difficult to swallow cocktail of the phenomenological Heidegger, Merleau-Ponty, Foucault, early Marx, according to which everything human is constituted in essence from the same mix of Sozannenheit, lived experience, perceptual cognitive forms, historical conditions, and that favorite metaphysical master concept of practice. Unless that metaphysics is spoken out and exposed of what it is, physics, the new explicitly metaphysical metaphysics of anthropology will not be yet. And that is the name. The proud world ontology, as Kant once said,
thank you.